Hello, I'm Bruce Celery. This is Moolah La, Money Made Simple. Stacey Brown and her 9-year-old daughter, Mickey, are using Zoom to teach financial literacy to kids. They call the weekly class Kidinomics. I'm angling for an invitation to join. Do you think I could score an invite? We'll have a conversation with them. And then finding a financial advisor that's right for you can be a big challenge, especially if you don't know what to look out for. Jesse Kaufman will be here to talk about his new service called Advice Check. You pay him a fee, he gives you a second opinion on your advisor. We'll also talk about the price of food on today's show. Spoiler alert, it's gone up, and it's even more expensive if you shop online. Sylvain Charlebois from the Agri Analytics Lab at Dalhousie University will be here. Chrissy Kay from Eat, Sleep, Breathe, FI will join us for our blogger spotlight. Plus, Benjamin Felix from PWL Capital will define factor investing, and how to use it. This is Moolah La, Money Made Simple. Let's get started. Financial literacy is so, so important for kids. Learn the lessons young, and those lessons will serve you for a lifetime. But how can we engage kids in the world of personal finance? We have talked about a lot of ideas on this topic on this show. First, because I believe it's important. And second, because I have a 10-year-old. So I am vested in this. Stacey Brown and her 9-year-old daughter, Mickey, have been working on this question themselves. Every Friday, they host a personal finance webinar. It is called Kidinomics. They both join me now to talk more about the Zoom class and how it works. Welcome to you both.
Thank you so much, Bruce, for having us on.
Thank you.
Mickey, what got you interested in money?
When I was younger, I wanted to go to Disneyland. So my mom decided to put me in stocks, and that's how I got interested in money, and I've been learning it for 5 years.
Wow. And did you get to go to Disneyland?
No.
I think something's there's a little gap in her credibility. She got you all interested, and then you didn't get on the plane.
Well, yeah. So she wanted to be a Disney princess for her birthday. And it's always been about, like, we're going to go to Disneyland, but there's always been something that comes up every year why we haven't. But that year she wanted to be Princess Tiana, amongst some other things, for her birthday. And so I asked her, well, how about you be something more than a Disney princess? How about you own a piece of Disney? And then she said, does that mean that I get all the toys that I want?
Yes. Very good question, Mickey. Very good question.
That is a good question from a 5-year-old, right? What you know about Disney. And I was like, no, I'm going to talk to you about stocks and owning a piece of Disney. So that year we bought stocks in Disney for her birthday. And so she's held stocks in Disney since she was 5. And from there, we've just done more things related to financial literacy, because I've always taught financial literacy, but to older people, to like older youth and young adults. And I was like, well, this really hit home for me, that the fact that kids need to learn about financial literacy, because kids naturally learn it through their parents, through osmosis. Like, they see how we handle money. And because they see how we handle money, that's their first formation as to how they're going to handle money, because they see how their parents handle money.
And yeah, and the good, the bad, and the ugly.
Exactly, right? So if you're a parent and you don't know necessarily all the right tools and skills to handle money, well, then we're not necessarily passing on healthy habits. And so I just thought, you know what? Well, if I'm having a challenge with, you know, trying to explain stocks to a 5-year-old, well, maybe other parents are too. And so we wrote a book together called
I Will Own a Castle.
We wrote a kid's book called I Will Own a Castle. And it was published in 2018. And it's about a little girl that wants to be several things for her birthday. And then her mom talks to her about owning a castle. And she ends up saving her money and investing in buying a castle.
I love it. Mickey, I want to ask you about Kidinomics, the weekly webinar that you do. If Abby were here — she's not here right now, she's at school — but if she were here, what would you tell Abby about how Kidinomics works and why she should come?
Well, I think she should come because we have, like, money experts. So we learn more and more about money each Friday. So I think that she should come because, but she'll learn more. And she'll learn more about money. And once she gets older, she'll make better decisions and she'll change the world and get education.
Oh my gosh, I love it. Are there snacks?
For us.
For you. So is this like an important thing that the viewers need to think about? Because I'm all about, Abby and I are all about the snacks.
Well, because our viewers, our kiddies, to keep make sure that it does stay private, we don't have cameras on. So they talk to us through the chat box to make sure that it's a safe community for Kiddynomics. So we don't use cameras. They can see us, but we can't see or hear them. So they chat to us through the chat box. So they can have all the snacks and the treats and health. Healthy snacks and nice water.
and not shoveling my face because I'm gonna get hungry.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, Mickey, what is one topic that you've talked about on Kiddynomics? One topic that was your favorite or was the most interesting for you?
Like all of them were interesting because I really didn't know that much. Mm. Public speaking was an interesting one because I usually don't public speak.
Right. Well, here you are on a radio interview, so that's pretty cool.
See, so she's putting her learning to the test of it, right?
100%. 100%. Stacey, tell me how you choose the guests and choose the topics that you are going to focus on. I'm using air quotes here. What does the curriculum look like?
So we don't necessarily have a laid out curriculum, but what I do go off of is what the kids tell me that they would like to learn more about. And then I try to make it into groups. So for me, I find that financial literacy should be all encompassing. So you'll find on our channel that we talk about everything from saving and bonds and stocks, the core financial literacy stuff, to other things such as setting a positive mindset towards money, public speaking, because we talked about entrepreneurship. So if you wanted to launch your own business, which some of the kiddies are actually, and you know, you need to be able to present your business to your family or friends to get seed money for your business. Well, you need to know how to speak publicly. And so we do things like public speaking and we've done vision boarding for kids. So to me, this is all encompassing for financial literacy. And we just try to make it fun. We make it fun and interesting every week so that the kids want to come back and learn about a different topic. And I think because, you know, no 2 weeks are necessarily the same. So it's always like really something new and fun and definitely not boring.
Stacey, a lot of parents, I mean, you and I are completely values aligned in terms of the importance of financial literacy and how much kids absorb good or bad in the home. Still, a lot of parents are hesitant to engage on this because they feel like they aren't doing it well already. What do you say to them? What do you say to them to either, you know, kick them in the pants to get moving or to provide a virtual Xanax so they can calm down and get to it?
Well, this is the fun thing about Kiddynomics and exactly why parents actually love it, because they can sit and watch. And what parents tell us is like they watch the webinars with their kids. And so they're learning secretly along with their child. And because the kids don't know that the parents don't know about this topic, now they're together and then they'll have a family discussion after it to talk about, okay, well, how can we incorporate real estate investing that we've done, you know, a couple of weeks ago or whatever the topic is into their household? Or how do we incorporate budgeting? If you never really budgeted before, well, now you have a course on it. You can watch it with your child. And you don't have to tell your kids that you didn't know anything about budgeting.
I love it. The parents are nodding going, oh yeah, absolutely what she said. Meanwhile, they're taking notes and thinking, exactly. I better Google that. I don't even know what that means.
Exactly. And then they can follow up after, right? And they're like, yeah, I'm taking notes for my child, but it's really for them. And the kids think, well, yeah, they're taking notes for me, right?
I love it. I love it. Mickey, Stacey, thank you so much for your time today. And congrats on this initiative. I think it's awesome.
Thank you so much for having us on.
Thank you.
Totally my pleasure. You're going to send me an email afterwards and tell me how I can audition to be a guest. I will say I have experience. I taught personal finance during the pandemic to 4 10-year-olds. Just about killed me, but I loved it. Right? Mickey, have a great time in your e-learning en français. Félicitations. And Stacey, thanks so much for your leadership on this. I really appreciate
Merci
it.
Beaucoup.
Thank you, Bruce.
A bientôt.
Okay.
Stacey Brown and her daughter Mickey are co-hosts of a weekly event called Kiddynomics. You can do a search on that. Past shows are available on YouTube, so you got to check them out. Their Facebook page, facebook.com/Kiddynomics.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
We have talked about the FIRE movement on this show before. It stands for Financial Independence Retire Early. For me, the stories of people who have chosen this path bring up equal parts excitement and horror. On the one hand, I'm like, it's so amazing. I would never do that. I love it. They're insane. So this week on our blogger spotlight, we're going to talk to Chrissy Kay. She writes Eat, Sleep, Breathe, FI. She joins us now from Vancouver, British Columbia. Hello there.
Hello, Bruce. Thank you for having me on.
Are you used to that response where people are like, oh my God, that's so great. You're crazy.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a very common response.
There are a lot of different blogs out there who focus on financial independence. Why did you choose to add your voice to this?
Well, for a few reasons. I wanted Canadians to know that it's possible to reach financial independence, even if you live in an expensive city, even with kids, and even on one income.
Vancouver's not Oh, wait. It's one of the most expensive cities, certainly in the country and in the world. What was the window into this as a lifestyle, as a goal? Because it really is about so much more than just retiring early. Like, there's a real culture to it. What opened that door for you?
For me, when I discovered it through Mr. Money Mustache, I don't know if your listeners have heard of him, but he's pretty famous. So because of him, I discovered there is this whole world. And aspirationally, it means you no longer have to work for money and you gain time and money freedom to decide what to do with the rest of your life.
What did you do differently? What are some of the choices that you made that said, okay, here's how we're going to reorient our lives such that we would have this opportunity? Are you making your children's shoes using, discarded leather and heavy needles and thread?
Definitely not.
Okay. Just checking.
I have to say, we didn't do anything outrageous. We are just optimizing our life in ways that not everybody does. You know, we didn't buy a much bigger house or a fancier house. We don't get the fanciest cars. We cook a lot at home. We try to DIY as much as we can, including investments. We try to focus really on optimizing and cutting the fat out of our lives and so that we can pour more money into the things we really value.
You are working in the home. You are the captain of that part of your family's life. Do you think at some point your partner will choose to stop work and you really will be financially independent and retired as a family?
I hope so. My husband is currently very happy at his job. And even though we are getting closer to our financial independence number, he has no desire to quit. He loves his job. But yes, eventually he would love to take a step back and spend more time on the things he really enjoys, his hobbies and his classic Mustang, for instance.
Oh, yeah. Do you get approval on whether he's allowed to buy that new muffler? Is that a discussion point?
Well, all our money is joint. And so we do discuss big purchases together. And we're lucky that we're on the same page with pretty much everything. So it's usually not really a point of contention.
What are the conversations that you have with your kids about this idea? Because you can imagine what conversations are like in my family with my 10-year-old about, you know, like there's a library. We do not have to buy that new book. There's a library. And she's like, bah, 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 bah. What are some of the examples of how these values kind of become a part of family discourse?
Yeah. So we talk about how there are many things we could afford, but we choose not to. It's not that we don't have the money. We have the money, but we're choosing to focus our money on things that really bring value to us, like traveling, for instance, or if they are looking at some toys, and we get them to really focus on, do you really want that? Do you really need that? And if so, then let's work on saving towards it. So those are some of the everyday conversations we have. And we also talk a bit about financial independence. And my kids are 12 and 15, and they're already very interested. They would like to focus on finding careers that they enjoy, but that can help them get there earlier so that they're free to pursue other interests earlier in life.
There's a difference in their temperament around money?
For sure. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, different from other kids. And also the two of them are quite different as well. One is, I think, slightly more of a saver, and one is slightly more interested in spending. But on the whole, they're both really good with their money.
What are the topics that your readers eat voraciously? Like you just need to, you know, change the font and they'll reread the blog because they're just desperate to talk more about that. What really rings true within the FIRE community?
I think anything that's unconventional. One of the more popular posts on my blog is, I say, you need an emergency plan, not an emergency fund. And what I mean by that is you need to really figure out what it is you need an emergency fund for, not just saving this random pot of money, but really think, do I need it to replace income? Is it that one of us may be injured or ill? So I really advocate for that mindfulness around money.
Where did this come from? In addition to the Money Mustache catalyst, but was this something that had a seed that had been planted, you know, decades earlier?
Well, I like to say my parents were the original mustachians. They were immigrants from Hong Kong. They were very frugal and they raised us that way. And so for us, we saw how they could make a dollar stretch and how they worked hard and how they never earned a lot of money when we were growing up, but they turned that into a very comfortable lifestyle for all of us. And my dad is now very comfortably retired. And so that's the seed of where this financial independence came from for me. I was already living the lifestyle for the most part. We just had to do a little bit more optimizing to really get ourselves there quicker.
The one yeah, but that some of our listeners will have would come from those who live in cities with expensive real estate. And they'll be like, yeah, but she probably bought her house, you know, a decade ago when it only cost $500,000 versus $5 million. How do you talk to those who aren't yet in the real estate market about how they can FIRE and also have a roof over their head?
It is true. It is more difficult for this generation, but it's not impossible. I know young people that are close to me that have purchased property in Vancouver or in the area. And it's diligent saving. It's purchasing wisely and not purchasing more than you need. And also looking at things like house hacking. So having roommates, or like us, having international homestay students, or living just a little bit farther away and living close to transit so you don't need a car. So there are ways to optimize. I'm not saying it's easy, but it is possible.
Very interesting stuff. Chrissy, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It was exciting for me to be asked, and I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
Awesome. Chrissy K writes, Eat, Sleep, Breathe, FI. She joined us from Vancouver, British Columbia. Stay with us. Coming up next on Moolala, the grocery store has gone digital. Sylvain Charlebois from Dalhousie University's Agri-Food Analytics Lab tells us about how online food purchasing has affected our pocketbooks. And later, Factor Investing. Kind of makes me think of Max Factor, you know, that cosmetics brand? Benjamin Tal from PWL Capital will be here. I don't think he's going to be wearing full makeup, but you never know. Missed an episode of Moolala? You can download full episodes of the show wherever you listen to podcasts. So, you know, whatever provider, or you can just go to the website, moolala.ca, and search for individual segments there. While you're there, leave us a review, subscribe to the podcast, because that makes it easier for other people to find us.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
The pandemic has affected all of our lives in so many ways, big and small. Take grocery shopping. So longer lines outside the store, arrows on the floor, the plexiglass, standard issue. Some people have also opted to buy their food online. Many people, you could argue. But how has the pandemic affected the price that we pay? Sylvain Charlebois is the Senior Director of the Agri-Food Analytics Lab at Dalhousie University. He joins us today from Halifax. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. How are you?
How has the pandemic affected the cost of food? Is it safe to say it's gone up in Canada?
Yes, it is quite safe. Well, I mean, even before COVID, you did see a disconnect between the general inflation rate and the food inflation rate. It's been going on for about a decade, which is why a lot of people are talking about food prices these days. But COVID really has accelerated or has increased that difference, that differential between the food inflation rate and the general inflation rate. Unfortunately, we're looking at a 23% difference over a decade. But this year, we're going to add probably another 3%, and that's why a lot of people are concerned about food prices, and they're noticing that their food bill is going up
because their salary's not going up on pace.
Exactly, and so there are a variety of reasons for that. But essentially, if you think that you're paying more for food, it's not a mirage.
It's not a failure of you to shop the bargains. It's actually
That's
happening.
Right.
Now, what are the main drivers of that increase?
So, it's obviously over the last few decades, you've seen a change. You've seen a shift in terms of how the industry is structured. It's always been a high volume, low margin business, but things are much, much more efficient now. And frankly, a lot of processors and grocers have invested heavily on aesthetics, experience, on quality. If you go back a decade ago, I would argue that the quality that we had in Canada is not the same as now. We have products from all over the world. We have more variety. The average grocery store carries 39,000 different products.
Wow.
That's a lot. And a decade ago, it was about 25,000. So we don't realize that as a consumer, but all these things do end up costing more because
Sobeys has said it's going to cost them somewhere around $20 million for PPE, for cleaning. Like, those are pandemic related costs.
Yeah.
Have the retailers been passing on those additional costs in the last 6 months in the form of increased prices?
Oh, absolutely. But here's the other twist that we're also seeing as a result of COVID. People are going online. They're shopping online. You need infrastructure. You need to invest. Loblaw's doing it. Walmart is doing it. Sobeys just launched its Voila by Sobeys in the GTA, and it's rolling out the service across the country. All that e-commerce is requiring more expenses. Voila, $500 million. Walmart, $3.5 billion. Someone has to pay for that. So it's all embedded in the cost of food.
What surprised me, one of the things that surprised me about your most recent report is that while the market share for online is increasing, it still seems much smaller than I would have thought. So tell us about the data that both the current market share and also the growth.
Before COVID, it was seriously a highly marginal market. 1.7% of all the food sold. Yeah, it's tiny. It was nothing. 1.7%. Most Canadians just didn't want someone else. They didn't know to pick their tomatoes and apples. That was the reality. But with COVID, people don't mind. They don't want to go to the grocery store. They don't want to go out as much. And they're liking the convenience of having stuff delivered to their homes. And so this year alone, we're expecting that number, the amount of sales conducted online in food, to triple this year alone. It's incredible.
Wow. So in relative terms, massive. In absolute terms, it's still not a huge part of the market share, but definitely growing. I want to ask you about the cost. So what did your analysis show in terms of the price one pays when they order online?
When you go online, so I actually believe, Bruce, that we're starting to leave this era of cheap food in Canada. It's been going on for about a decade, as I explained earlier, but with e-commerce, I think it's clearly going to be a complete departure from that era of cheap food, because there's basically no discounting online. I don't know if you've been online, but discounts are rare, very rare. And on top of that, you have to pay a delivery fee or a subscription fee. And this is where it's getting interesting, because a lot of grocers and CPG companies who are, a lot of companies out there are trying to sell to the consumer. They're looking at two models. Either they'll go with a subscription model or a delivery fee. And I think the former will eventually prevail, because you can embed that cost into the cost of food, essentially. You won't see that cost anymore. Delivery fees tend to really ache consumers. They don't like to pay extra for food. Maybe for like a dry cleaner, not a vacuum cleaner or something they're buying for their homes, but for food, yeah, a $4 or $5 delivery fee, it bothers them.
Well, and Amazon Prime has made us, has given us the expectation that we don't have to pay for delivery, because at Amazon, if we pay that fee or we order enough, we don't have to. I want to ask you about the dynamic of the restaurant industry. So they have been hit so brutally, not so much in the Atlantic region, of course, you're part of that bubble, but across the rest of the country. And so have their suppliers. In the early days, you'd be in a regular grocery store, and I saw a 20-pound bag of Parmesan. I'm not kidding you, of Parmesan.
Yeah.
So how has the decline for restaurants changed the dynamic for grocery stores for a consumer buying and cooking at home?
You've heard the word pivot, I'm sure, 20,000 times since the beginning of COVID. Well, that's basically what's going on. But I would say this, Bruce, I actually think that the pandemic is democratizing the supply chain. Everyone has access to the consumer now because of e-commerce. But this blurring line we've been talking about between service and retail for a few years now, well, COVID blew everything up. There is no line anymore. You're seeing Loblaws selling meal kits coming from restaurants to consumers. You're seeing Kraft Heinz operating a ghost kitchen in the GTA to serve meals, encouraging people to use an app on their phone to deliver meals to people's homes from Kraft Heinz. I mean, 8 months ago, nobody would have thought about that, but it's happening. Everything, all companies right now in the food space are thinking differently about their own role within the supply chain.
One of the worrying trends is around food security. We know that this is a very precarious time for a lot of families, and your observation is that food insecurity is on the rise.
Yes, absolutely. So the ratio in Canada before COVID was 1 in 8. So 1 Canadian 8 experienced food security. It was a perceived sentiment. We believe, with some work done with Food Banks Canada, we believe that ratio went down to or up 1 out of 7 instead of 1 out of 8 as a result of COVID. People lost their jobs. Their financial situation has changed. It's pretty. And I hate to say this, Bruce, but I actually don't think we're going to see the end of it. I think the worst is still yet to come with the fall and winter, because that's where you're going to see a lot of bankruptcies. You're going to see a lot of creditors basically pulling the plug on their customers, unfortunately.
Yeah, worrying time. Sylvain, thank you for your time today. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Sylvain Charlebois, the Senior Director of the Agri-Food Analytics Lab at Dalhousie University. He was here to talk about the price of food. Stay with us. Coming up next on Moolala, can't seem to find the right financial advisor. Jesse Kaufman has some ideas on what you should look for. His company is Advice Check, and he has got a model for assessing your financial advisor's performance. Later, Stacey Brown and her daughter Mickey are back for the Moolala questionnaire. If you're looking for some light reading on personal finance, Moolala is my first book. It's subtitled Why Smart People Do Dumb Things With Their Money and What You Can Do About It. I should get a copy to Sylvain. He probably needs it.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Finding a great financial advisor can be tough, and it's even harder when you don't know exactly what you're looking for. Jesse Kaufman is the founder and CEO of Advice Check. It is a platform or service that provides assessments of financial advisors so investors can determine if they are on the right track. Jesse's here to tell us how it works. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. Thanks very much for having me.
What's your two sentences on what the service is that you provide here?
Help people determine if their financial advisors are doing right by them and doing a good job in earning their fees.
And what criteria do you ascribe to that question?
We look at their decision-making process, how the advisor is thinking about their investments and how they make decisions on what to buy. The actual investment selection itself, what particular investments they're using. Of course, their performance, the fees that they charge, the commitment to ongoing education and excellence in their field, and their ethics, their reputation, and any conflicts of interest they might have.
Some of those are very easy. You look at the statement and you could look at the performance versus some benchmarks. Some would be very hard. How do you assess those last two that you talked about, which are really kind of like practice management and they're values oriented?
That's a great question. And normal people don't know how to do this because, well, they're normal. But after 13 years as an advisor, I know how they think. I know how they're motivated and I know all the tricks they use. So I can look at your statements and tell you how they're making the decisions, how they're getting paid, if there's anything coming in the back door, what conflicts they might be, and whether you're getting sound advice and value for your money. So we look at their education. We speak with them if our clients permit us to get in front and actually have a conversation with the advisor. And through triangulation in the industry, through my career, I know a few people at a few places, and it's not that difficult to find out what someone's reputation or history is if I don't know them already.
Why would an investor come to you? Are they suspicious? Are they dealing with problems? What would bring them to seek you out?
I honestly think that every investor should, if for no other reason as to have peace of mind and the second opinion to know that they are on the right track, even if they feel that's the case. In reality, most of the people who do come are somewhat suspicious or concerned. And frankly, this started with my mom, who after a number of years that I'd been in the industry, she asked me to take a look at her statements. And when I did, I was horrified. Mm. There were all sorts of back-end charges, DSC fees, and an asset mix more appropriately geared to a 20-year-old than a 60-year-old. And it was full of risk, exposure to the markets. And her whole future was effectively dependent on stock markets going up. It was like a meatball on top of spaghetti. Everything's teetering right on the edge of the table. And if no one sneezes, she's okay. But if the market did sneeze, she'd be mush. So if there are concerns around retirement or wondering if you're getting good value for the fees you're paying, get a second opinion from an unbiased source, which is what separates us from others. We have no stake in the outcome. We don't want your business. We don't want to become your advisor. Simply want to give you an accurate assessment of the work your advisor is doing.
You sell a number of packages. The standard one's just under $1,000. It goes up from there. The highest level includes an advisor meeting add-on. If I'm the advisor, you have totally annoyed me with this request. I'm like, who's this Jesse guy? I am not talking to him. Why would someone pick up the phone and take your questions?
Well, first, if their client asks them to, they're pretty much obligated to if they want to retain that client. But in my opinion, a good advisor should be thrilled to be independently vetted and have an organization say, yes, this person is doing great work. And that's the case. If the advisor is doing great work, there's nothing that makes us happier. However, some people are scared of that, like you said, and a little reticent. But if the client asks, can you meet my advisor and ask the advisor to speak with us, then they typically do.
How should an investor address this with their advisor? Hey, I'm just calling for a second opinion. Doesn't mean I don't trust you.
You know, that's a great question too. And I found a lot of people are afraid or scared to broach the subject, but it's your money and it's your future. And if something's going wrong, it's you who's eating cat food in retirement, not the advisor. You owe your future self an obligation, a fiduciary duty to make sure that you're okay. So there is absolutely nothing wrong with getting an independent second opinion to make sure you're on track. And a client should have every confidence in saying to their advisor that that's what they're doing. Some people choose not to involve their advisor, and we don't meet with the advisor, and they just come to us and we go through the material and the statements, and that can work too if they don't want the advisor to know. So it's up to you.
There is an enormous power imbalance here between advisor and client, mostly in terms of perception, because the client can walk at any time. But I talk to people all the time who aren't even comfortable enough asking a question if there's something that they don't understand. So how do you address that? How do you enforce for the investor that they're actually the ones with the power and they have nothing to be ashamed of to demand that they're getting value for the price that they pay?
That's exactly what I'm trying to do. Similar to the reasons you started Moolala, I want to inspire and educate people, help them live the life that they want, and understand that they need to take responsibility and accountability for their future. So it's not something they should be scared of doing, but something empowering. Because when your advisor comes to you every year, tells you, oh yes, everything's fine and you're on track, don't worry, everything's good, how do you know if that's really the case? You don't, because you're an expert in your life and what you do and not in this, but I am and we are. And we can help you look into this and determine if you are in fact on the right path and if any changes need to be made. And if they do, it's very important to make them.
Very briefly before we go, you are a former advisor. You could make a lot more money being in that business than in this one. Why did you leave? Why did you change? You have 30 seconds.
And I used to. I wanted to make a difference, Bruce. I wanted to have a bigger impact. I saw a lot of bad work being done in the industry by advisors who are basically just salespeople. And I wanted to shine a light on that so that clients could be informed and, as you said, demand better, which would lead to a better financial world for all.
Wow. Nice. And under 30 seconds. Jesse, thanks very much.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Jesse Kaufman is the founder and CEO of Advice Check. It is a service that you can retain to get a second opinion on the work of your financial advisor. Stay with us. Coming up later, we'll take Stacey Brown and her daughter, Mickey, through the Moolala questionnaire. But first, Factor Investing. Ben Felix from PWO Capital will be here with a who, what, when, where, and how on this strategy. We might even address why too. Don't forget, we have a newsletter. It brings together all the fun stuff that I've been up to over the prior month. This radio show, my columns on CBC, on CityLine, it comes once a month. I'm never going to do anything with your email. So if you want to sign up, go to moolala.ca.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Factor Investing. It makes me think of that cosmetics brand called Max Factor, the makeup of makeup artists. I know I am probably the only person who has ever made that connection. And in my heart, I know that it has nothing to do with that, but I should, because I think it would add some glamour, some sheen to what could be kind of a boring topic, but Ben Felix will not let that happen. He is our guest. He's a portfolio manager at PWL Capital. He joins us now from Ottawa. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Bruce.
Do you wear Max Factor? Have you ever tried some of their mascara products or anything like that? Maybe even on Halloween?
Your introduction was the first time that I've ever heard of Max Factor.
Oh my God, you need to be in the tween demographic and then you would have known. It was a competitor to like CoverGirl and Revlon. I still think it exists. I used to work at Procter & Gamble. We sold cosmetics. Okay, I digress. Factor investing is a thing. Define it.
Okay, so factors are well, there are different ways to think about them, but one of the most common ways is as the types of risks that are getting that end up getting included in stock prices. So when you purchase a stock, when you purchase a share in a company, you're theoretically, this is financial theory here, you're purchasing the expected future cash flows of that company. Those cash flows are not guaranteed. They're risky. So you purchase them at a discount. I mean, this is what investing is. You're purchasing future cash flows at a discount. That discount rate in the academic literature is going to depend on a few specific types of risks. Everybody, and maybe not everybody, a lot of people are familiar with the market risk. When you invest in the stock market, you're taking on market risk. That is a factor. Market risk is a factor. There are a bunch of other factors, and by a bunch, I mean a bunch. There are hundreds that have been identified in the academic literature. There are five that are really broadly accepted and well-known. And so in a portfolio, you can choose to take all of those risks. Now, risk sounds scary. It sounds like a bad thing. It's actually not, because when you're combining multiple independent risks together in a portfolio, you end up with a better portfolio. You end up with more diversification.
And you take a no risk, you get a no return, as the phrase goes. So it's important to have risk. You just need to be smart about it. And typically we talk about diversifying to mitigate risk in terms of asset allocation, maybe geography, maybe market cap. What are some of the factors that might be less well known?
Yeah. So like we both mentioned, market risk is the big one. When you go and buy a market capitalization weighted index fund, that's a traditional S&P 500 or S&P TSX index fund, you're only getting exposure to the market risk factor. The other factors in this main factor model that I made reference to are company size. So smaller companies, that's the size risk factor. Now that's an independent risk. So smaller companies are independently risky compared to the market as a whole. There's also value, or another way to state that is relative price. Mm-hmm. So if a company has a lower price relative to its book value, that's known as a cheaper stock, a value stock. So the cheapest stocks within the market are value stocks. Owning those gives you exposure to, again, an independent risk factor, the value risk factor. There are a couple of other ones, profitability and investment. They're a little bit harder to define. And when we're talking about factor investing with ETFs, they're a little bit less important.
What are the benefits? Why should we be having this conversation, and why should we be having it now?
Well, it's tricky. So getting factor exposure is theoretically a very good thing. Practically, it's a little bit challenging. I have a podcast, and associated with that podcast, we have this discussion forum, and there's a whole thread within that forum with a bunch of people who spend way too much time nerding out about this stuff, talking about how they implement their factor portfolios. So it's not the same thing as just buying an index fund, which is relatively easy. Factor investing is a little bit more involved, but why it's important is that the independent risks. So if we just use the example of the size premium, that's the excess return of small cap stocks, and the value premium, they have delivered pretty significant excess returns over and above what the market has delivered over the long term. And they've done so at different times throughout history. So if there's a decade where the market does not deliver a positive return, which happened in the US from 2000 to 2009, US stocks were flat for a decade. It's known as the lost decade, fittingly. Over that same time period, small cap value stocks and value stocks in the US actually did very well. So times like that is where you really see that diversification benefit show up. That's why it's important, but it's also not for everybody.
There are some Canadian factor funds. You're not a huge fan. They don't deliver for you. So I'm just going to ignore them. But there are some US products that you believe in. Can you give me an example of one and why it deserves mention?
Sure. So we did a paper about this last year. And in that paper, we identified IJS, which is a US listed ETF that tracks the S&P 600 Small Cap Value Index. Now, that fund gives you very pure exposure to, well, like it's like the name sounds, small cap value stocks. So it's a very low cost way to get very strong exposure to the small cap value premium. So we like that a lot. Since we did that paper, a new company launched in the United States called Avantis, and they've come out with a whole suite of ETFs that are specifically designed to track the factors that we're talking about right now. So we're working on a new paper with a model portfolio included that includes those products, but those should be on anybody's radar if they're thinking about this.
Very briefly, we've only got like 30 seconds left to go. How do you think about the percentage of a portfolio that should be exposed or targeting one of those factors that is outside the very basics of market risk? Because you typically we talk about, you know, you can do okay with four ETFs, Canada, US, international, fixed income. If you were to add another element in there, does that take the place of one of those four, or is it a sweetener?
So you'd be reducing your market cap exposure a little bit by reducing your allocation to the market cap weighted index fund to add in these factor funds. The amount that you add in is going to depend on risk tolerance and tolerance for complexity as well. If we just added in the single small cap value ETF that I mentioned, that's not too bad. If we start adding in additional factor ETFs for value stocks in the US and for international value and small value, the portfolio starts to get a lot more complicated. The percentage to allocate, again, you're going to get more tracking error with factor exposure. I mean, you're going to do better or worse than the market. That can be hard for some people to deal with. So that's a major consideration as well.
Ben, thanks very much for this.
Thanks, Bruce. It was great.
Ben Felix is with PWL Capital. If you'd like to read that white paper he referenced, just do a search for PWL Capital and factor investing, and you will find it there. Time now for the Moolala questionnaire. Now, as you know, this is a segment that we do on each and every show, and we ask a whole bunch of questions of our guests. But what makes this extra special today is it's a twofer. So it is not just one guest, it is two. It is Stacey Brown and her daughter, Mickey. Hello to you both.
Hi.
Okay, Mickey, I'm going to ask this first question to you. How would you describe your money personality? So would you be like, I'm a spender, I'm a saver, I'm conservative, I'm impulsive? When you think about how you behave when it comes to money, what do you think is a word that describes you best?
I really like to save my money, you know, because I don't just like spending random things on my money. I just don't like to really spend. That's not my thing.
Yeah. When you have spent your money on something, if you think back to like something that you have bought, what is something that you've used your money on in the last little while that you go, whew, that was money well spent. I am so glad I bought that. I love it. I still love it.
My tablet.
Your tablet. Oh, I totally get it. I completely see why that would be the thing that you love. Beautiful, beautiful. Stacey, to you, who was your money mentor growing up? Who would you say really imprinted on you when you were Mickey's age?
My mom.
And what did she do? Yeah. What was she like?
So my mom was a person that always looked for sales and coupons. To purchase things that we needed in the house. And I think that has imprinted a lot in our house. Because I'm always like,
Mickey's laughing. She's like, ugh, yes.
Yep.
And Stacey, what would you say is one of your guiltiest spending pleasures? Do you have any guilty spending pleasures, even those that you don't feel guilty about that someone else might try and make you feel guilty about?
Yeah, she has a lot of Gucci stuff.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, Mickey, tell me.
Bag, clothes, bag, shoes.
You know what? This is my kitchen.
Wait.
Oh, my gosh.
Out of the mouths of babes.
Oh, my goodness. The kids tell you everything. You want to know the truth.
They tell you everything. Okay, well, there's our answer.
She's right.
What, Stacey, does financial freedom mean to you?
Options. That's what financial freedom means, is it gives you the options to say, okay, guess what? Today I'm not feeling well. I'm able to stay home and be sick and not worry about my finances. Or today I feel like flying, well, not right now through the pandemic, but today I feel like flying out of the country and take a 2-week vacation. Well, you have the option to do that. And that's what, to me, financial freedom means. Gives you options.
Mickey, what are you like when you go to a store? I mean, in regular times, when you're like, you got to go to the mall and you're going to pick some stuff up. Are you like, oh, I'll just browse around and like hang out? Or are you like, I must have this thing, and your mom has to, I don't know, talk you down from the 14 things that you see and you want? Because some kids have a really, really hard time in stores. You know, they just get overwhelmed with all the options and want to buy everything. What are you like in a store?
I'm like every single child. Like, if I go to the mall, like, I will ask if I can come. And then after, if my mom says no, I will beg her until she says yes. And then when we go to the mall, I will ask to go to every store that I want. And then after, if she says yes, then I'll go look at something and ask if she can buy it. If she says no, I'll just keep on begging her until she says yes.
How often, Mickey, honestly, how often does she cave and give it to you?
Well, not often, but only if it's like, if I did a good job on something, or if I had good grades, or if it's my birthday.
Right, right. Or if she's feeling guilty because she just got a new Chanel blouse and a pair of a Louis Vuitton handbag, and she's like, oh my gosh, I better buy Mickey something, given that I dropped $5,000 at Holtz.
No, we are not those spenders. And
no, I know. Of course you're not.
She knows that if it's not on a list and if it's not a need, it's not something that we'll be getting.
Well, I need it, not you.
Yes.
Those shoes will come to you. Just wait till your feet grow.
Right, right.
Stacey, what is one topic that you could talk about, could do on Kidinomics, that you would just do anytime because you love it, you feel so passionate about it? Is it debt? Is it investing? Is it savings? Is it credit card? What is a topic that you could talk about endlessly?
Credit. I think credit is the most vital thing for financial literacy. I think credit, I always say this, if credit is not the most important thing, then it's the most important thing.
And when you say credit, do you mean your credit score, like your reputation with lenders, or credit?
Everything about credit, understanding credit. How does it work? How, if you have bad credit, then how do you, or credit that has been damaged. I don't like to tell people that they have bad credit. So if you've had credit that's been damaged, how do you repair your credit? How do you handle credit cards? How do you handle online, you know, online privacy towards your credit? Everything regarding credit, because credit is something that if you don't have money, or if you do have money, can help you in the long run.
Mickey, I think you should make millions and then loan some of those millions to your mother at an exorbitant interest rate. Exorbitant. Like, mom, I'll totally cut you a check. It'll cost you 15%. That's just the way it's going to go.
We've learned about assets and liabilities and those loans that have high interest rates and what we should do with those, right?
I believe it. I love it. Well, thank you both so much for joining us today. We really, really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having us on.
Take care, Mickey. Talk to you soon. Mickey. Bye. And her mom. Like, there was some other person there. I think it was her mom, but clearly Mickey is the most important person on the entire show today.
Absolutely.
Because she's learning about money. Woo! That is our show for today. If you want to stay up to date on all things Moolala, you can subscribe to our newsletter. Just go to moolala.ca. While you're at it, subscribe to this podcast. Rate it. Review it. Awesome. If you have questions or comments, our email address is ask@moolala.ca. ask@moolala.ca. That is the email address that Stacey is going to use to invite me to join her on Kidinomics, because I've put the plug in so many times. I am on social media at Bruce Selry Twitter, Bruce Selry Moolala on Facebook. Thank you so much for joining us, and have a great day.